My name is Jason Doldane, and I'm the host of Reaching Roots, a podcast with a goal to make life easier for parents and families so they can reach further. We're talking to people who inspire us with their journey, tell us about the problems they are solving, and provide us insight that helps us and our children learn and grow. Society's chief responsibility is to raise children who will become the best possible citizens of the world and who will maximize their ability so they fulfill their potential. Parents, guardians, and educators bear upon them this responsibility to raise children who are productive citizens. As a zealous advocate that every person has an opportunity to maximize their human potential, Nate Turner created a backward-designed life process to help his unborn child become a great global citizen without means of wealth, privilege, legacy status, or wrongdoing. Nate's son not only met Harvard's admission benchmarks, but scored in the top 1%, learned 4 languages, played soccer in Brazil, started a foundation to address teen homelessness, and went on to do his engineering PhD. In this episode, we talked to Nate about the techniques and strategies that helped him raise a successful Gen Zer and the blueprint that he shared with parents through his history-making book, Raising Superman. Nathaniel Turner is an author, a TED speaker, and describes himself as a humanity propulsion engineer. He is the author of several books, including the children's book series, The Amazing World of STEM, and has been featured in The Washington Post, Black Enterprise, iHeartRadio, The Good Men Project, SiriusXM, and the U.S. News and World Report. Welcome, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
Good. Now I know your name is Nathaniel, but I read somewhere that you go by the name Nate. So that's a lot easier to pronounce.
Yeah, and it means that I'm not in trouble with you, because the only time someone uses Nathaniel is when I'm in trouble.
So, Nate, tell me a little bit about your background and how you kind of got started.
So I'm a guy from Gary, Indiana, originally. My parents, Tommy and Gladys, lower middle class folks, neither one of them had a college educated. My grandparents, I believe only one of them finished the 9th grade. The other three, I think the best was 6th grade. So I don't come from a highly educated family, the first person in my family to go to college and then subsequently earn a master's and a terminal degree. And for the last 25 years or so, I've mostly run a financial planning practice, although a decent amount of time over the last 6 to 8 years, I've been in this space with parents and education.
Got it. And I think you've got like a few degrees now, right?
I do have a bachelor's in accounting, a master's in history and theology, and a law degree.
Wow. So take us back to, your book, Raising Superman, and obviously the thought of that seemed like it was a life's journey of you actually thinking about this before your son was born, and then sort of almost designing his life. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I have my father passed in on Mother's Day of 2018, but I had a very precarious relationship with my father. As time has passed, I used to say it was tumultuous. We had bad times, but as time has passed, I've had an opportunity to see my father from a different lens. Something happens when people are no longer here with you, that you're now forced to look only at them as opposed to having an interaction with them. So I see my father a little bit differently. I guess the point of it is, at the time when I learned I was going to be a father, I wanted to be so much better than my father. I wanted to be completely opposite to my father without realizing that my father had given me some good things. I just couldn't see it at the time. Right. One of the things I wanted to do better than my father was to make sure that my son and I had memories that were positive, because I couldn't think of anything that was good about my time with my father. So I started writing letters, notes. I initially started just writing notes about what my aspirations were for my son. And then he was 2, he walked to the mailbox with me one afternoon and asked me, when was he going to get mail? And I said, hey, man, these are bills. That, you know, he said, no, but I want mail, Daddy. And so it dawned on me that maybe this was a time to write him. And as I started to write him, things just started flowing out that I never intended. So what went from writing postcards and greeting cards turned to me writing him letters. And it just stuck. Right. He enjoyed reading his father's letters. And in time, I realized it was a unique way to communicate with a child. It held me accountable in ways that I wouldn't have been accountable by just saying words out loud. And so we just kept writing. One day he decided that, and I guess we'll talk about that later, but it was his decision to publish the letters.
Oh, very interesting. So how long did you write these letters for?
I still write him. So I started writing him in a formal format at age 2. And I wrote him a series of letters from 2 to 16. And when he was ready to leave to go to Brazil, I put some of the letters in a binder and gave them to him. I said, you're going to be 7,000 miles away. We're not going to have the chance to interact as we do all the time, but maybe you'll find some value in some of the things that I wrote to you in the past. So I put the letters in a binder. And then I left and went to Rio for a few days. He was in a city called Porto Feliz in Brazil. My wife called me and said, you're going to have to go back to the academy where he is. I don't think he's going to make it. He's having a really hard time adjusting. I've talked to him a few times. He's not adjusting very well. So I go back to the academy and I'm expecting him to have his bags packed ready to go. And he's got a big smile on his face. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? He said, did you put the letters in any particular order? And I said, no. I said, I reread the first 3. I remember my purpose. I'm going to be fine. And here's what we're going to do, though. Whenever I do come home, we're going to take these letters and we're going to publish them. We're going to share with other families. Because, Daddy, when you tell me I can do something, not only do I believe I can do it, I know it's supposed to happen.
That's amazing. Yeah. So let's go back to some of those first 3 letters. I mean, what was kind of the core essence of those?
So what I wanted to do is write him in a way that even as a 2-year-old, they had value, but they also would have value at 32.
Right. And by the way, just before that, Nate, how old is your son today?
He's 26, just turned 26, June 27th.
Yep. Okay, all right. So let's go back to the 3 letters then.
So I just wanted to write him. I wanted to say something that mattered. Because here's the deal. Here's my father and I. We didn't speak for over 20 years. And now I've got this son. And so when my son was born, I took him to see my father. I called my father and said, Dad, you got a grandson. Come see him. He didn't come. So my wife and I get in the car and we drive to his house. And I say, here's your grandson. And I extend my arms to hand him to him. He extends his arms to push him away and said, take that baby. You know, I don't like babies. Bring him back when he's 21.
Wow.
And so I'm like, okay, man, you've been rejecting me for years and now you're rejecting my son. And I don't want in any way to ever have a situation like that for him. So I'm like, well, at least I'll just write him. If I write him and tell him how much I love him and what I hope for him, if I mess it up like my father did, at least he'll have some recollection that his father actually did love him. So that's where the letters originated, with me just wanting to find a way to leave my son a legacy that his dad at some point wasn't a complete jerk. And he actually did love him.
Amazing. So let's go back to kind of what you call this backward sort of design process. Now, I'm assuming that wasn't like the intent when you started writing your first, you know, 2 or 3 letters. And, you know, you now look in hindsight and say, hey, that's kind of what you created, right?
Right. So what I wanted to do was, again, I wanted to be better than my father. Yeah. And one of the things that my father would say to me, so I'd finished law school and my father said to me, you know, you should be a congressman or a senator by now. And I was like, man, how do you come from where we came from and become a congressman or a senator unless somebody has a pathway to help you to do that?
Right.
And so as much as it pissed me off, it gave me sort of this inclination that, well, maybe in some ways what he's suggesting to me in his crude way is that you need a pathway if you're going to help your child do better than you. And so I was thinking about education at the time. So I wrote Harvard. And it was the time when you couldn't just go online. There was no internet. So I wrote Harvard for an application. Harvard sent the application. And embedded in this application from Harvard were these three things that now became the template that we used to backward design his life. Harvard's application, of course, asked for students who did well academically. Then it said, that at the time they said, we want world citizens. We want people who are world citizens. And I was like, okay. And the third thing it says that they wanted students who care for something greater than themselves. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So we need to raise somebody who does well academically. This is very early on. We need to raise somebody who, for us, was maybe can speak another language. And we need to raise somebody who's a good person. And so that became the template that we used for everything that we did in his life.
Got it. So obviously the academic piece
was to get him to Harvard, was to make sure he could meet the standards of Harvard.
Right, right. And I think most parents will kind of understand that, right? Because, right. You know, we've got all this kind of like formalized educational institutions around us that kind of help us with that. Talk to me a little bit about the world citizens piece.
So I'm an African American, and oftentimes in this country, when we think of,
you just cut out there a little bit, Nate.
I'm sorry.
Can you hear me? Oh, there we go. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Just repeat that last part.
So I'm African American, obviously, and I shouldn't say obviously because I could be Caribbean or something, but sure. Most of the time in this country, when we talk about diversity, we talk about diversity oftentimes from the lens of people, quote unquote, of color. But when we think about diversity in terms of the planet, the planet doesn't talk about people in terms of whether or not I'm African American and I live in America. And so I wanted to make sure that I raised a child who understood and could respect the values of people beyond just those who look like him or those who are quote unquote white. And so that's what we wanted to do. So that initially was introducing him to other languages, but then it also was like, well, we introducing him to other people's cultures and ideals and so forth so that he could be a global citizen as opposed to being just a kid who focused on his own color scheme and whether or not that meant he was diverse.
Yeah, amazing. So what are some of the things that you actually did to help him with that?
So one of the things we do is we do this thing that's called like a domestic exchange. So like until we could leave America, we would say whenever we would go somewhere, we would go to a different community. So if we went to Miami as an example, we go to Little Havana because, right? And when we were teaching him, when he was learning Spanish, wherever we went, we made sure he could go someplace where he could speak the language authentically with people who spoke only that language. And so he's had a chance to leave the country a little bit now. But yes, as an example, I have a couple who I consider my Jewish parents. And so when it got time for us to, when he was turning 13 and we were saying, well, what do we do now, right? What do we do now? Because there's no ceremony per se for him to recognize him in terms of this. Now he's a man. I talked to them and said, hey, what do I do? What do you do for bar mitzvah? Can I borrow some of that? And will you help me create this thing called a black mitzvah? And so this Jewish family helped me to create this thing for my son when he turned 13.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So really, you know, sort of what I take away from that is that, you know, you're really expose your son to different cultures. And I think the kind of like sort of underline on some of this is that to do that, you can do that in your backyard because most cities will have sort of pockets of different cultures that we just have to kind of walk a few miles to expose them to and not necessarily have to travel, you know, and cross oceans.
Correct. I mean, again, so I'm in Indianapolis now, and it's funny because sometimes we'll get a chance to talk about diversity. As people say, well, how did you raise this young man who speaks all these languages and stuff? Yeah. And I said, well, one thing you have to do is you just have to be comfortable leaving your own neighborhood. Right. In America, I say, you know, we spend, what we care about is where we spend our money. Right. So I said, how many times, and I'll say this to black folks, I said, how many times have you spent time with a Turkish family? Or how many times have you gone to a Jewish synagogue? Like diversity can't just be about somebody coming and doing something in your environment. Diversity, true diversity, a holistic diversity is that we all get out and we will spend our money in places that we ordinarily don't spend our money. So see a different dentist, let somebody else do your hair, go to a different restaurant. Like don't just go eat at the restaurant, talk to the owners of the restaurant, get to know some people in different communities.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, great advice. The third thing that you actually mentioned was, I think it was, you know, we want people who care about others more than they do for themselves. And right. So in that particular one, you know, what did you do to help him sort of develop those kind of capabilities?
So first of all, we didn't name him for 8 days. So that was a big part of it. There's the ancient tradition that you wait 7 days, watch the child's characteristics and so forth unfold, and then you name the child. But we took it a further step. If we had known you and you were part of the village, we would have given you a list of names that we thought we were interested in, and we would have asked you to come over and spend time with the baby and tell us what you thought the baby's name should be, right? So we wanted a village to feel responsible for the child, almost like the Lion King. Do you remember in the very early part, they Mufasa, they hold him. And so that's what we were thinking. And so his name, our son's name is Naeem Kahari Turner - Bendeli. Naeem is Arabic for benevolent. Kahari is Swahili for kingly. Turner is a slave name, right? And Bendeli is Yoruba for born away from home. So his full name is, he is a benevolent king, despite being born from slavery and born away from home. And we would tell him as he was growing up that he was a king and he's supposed to be a good king, and that the people who are around him are part of the kingdom, and your responsibility is to be good to the people that are part of the kingdom. And we remind him even now that the most important word in all the human language is who, because when he dies, it said on your obituary, it talks about who you are. And your eulogy will talk about who you are. And on your tombstone, it'll talk about who you are. Not what you did, not how much money you made. It'll just talk about who you were as a human being. So that's been, and everything we do is always about the who. I didn't mean to rhyme, but it is the case.
Amazing. So I want to go back to your father, because you mentioned something about the fact that, you know, the last 2 years since he passed away, you've come to think of him a bit differently. Tell us a little bit about sort of, you know, how have things changed for you?
So I do this thing. It's called journaling forward. I write about my best life in advance. So you might find an entry I've written, it'll be about something that'll happen 10 years from now. And oftentimes as I'm writing now, I find myself hearing my father's voice. My father, for example, my father taught me as a 10-year-old, I wanted a 10-speed bike. And he told me the year before when I was 9 and he bought me a bike, he said, you don't want this dirt bike, you want a 10-speed bike. And I was like, no, I want this dirt bike. Well, the following year, right, I wanted the 10-speed bike. And he said, I told you last year, you should have gotten the 10-speed bike. So in essence, he's telling me about how to look forward, but all I could do was see the present. And so those are kind of things. And so then he further said, if you want the bike, Nate, you know, if a man wants to eat, a man has to work. And I'm like, dude, I'm 10 years old. What do you want me to do? So he walks me out in the garage. He gives me a lawnmower, points to the lawnmower, a shovel, and a rake. And he said, go at it until you can afford your bike.
Yeah.
And so now when I look back on it, like I've been in business for myself for 25 years, I'm thinking about life forward instead of in the present. Like, and so those are things I got from my father, but I was so angry for a long time. I couldn't see that he'd actually given me some good tools. Whether or not he was always a good teacher, we can debate that, but he did give me some good tools.
Yeah, you know, I think most parents are probably guilty of the same thing, right? We tell our kids, because we consider that we have some experience in life, right? Or at least more than our 2-year-old or a 10-year-old, we tend to preach. Obviously our kids don't have the same perspective, and so they're just not going to understand, right? So you're kind of describing a little bit of that that kind of conflict between yourself and your father. But having seen that now, I mean, how do you change that message to your child?
So one of the things I try to do with Naeem is, this is where the letters became really helpful. Because when you're writing, and if you write intentionally,
yep,
you can remove the emotionality from the writing. One of the things that happens when sometimes when you communicate with children is they look at your face, and if you're smiling, they're smiling. Yep. If you're frowning, they're frowning. The yep. Whatever words you say, they may completely miss those. And you could be angry and they'll miss your message because of the anger. You could also be excited and they'll miss like the process that made you excited. And when I wrote him, that helped me to remove all of that. And so that's very different than my father. My father might talk to me when he's angry and he might have a really good lesson, I gotta somehow unpack the lesson from the anger. I can't do that as a child,
right?
Or if I do something good and he hugs me, I'm like, well, what did I actually do? Because I don't know how to repeat it. But when I write Naeem, I would tell him exactly how to repeat it. Today, you had a great day. But do you know why? It wasn't because you finished first in the race. It was because last week and a week before that and a week before that, you did all of these things consistently. And that is the lesson in life, right? Yeah. So those were the letters would do for us.
Makes sense. You know, and I guess it kind of strikes me that obviously it helps you speak unemotionally, but also it allows the child to kind of like, you know, read it when they're in a better listening mode.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or go back now, he's 25, 26, and he can pick up the letters and he'll say, okay, this is what my father told me at 13, but the message is still the same message, right?
Yeah.
Still got to work. I still got to get up early, right? Yeah. The message that didn't change.
Yeah, I'm sure it means something different every time he reads it.
Yes. And one interesting thing is that he shared the book with other people. So he's had other students who've asked him what they should do. And he was like, well, here, let me give you what my father gave me.
Yeah. Which is
like, it's incredible when he does that.
Awesome gift. Yeah. So you talk about, you describe yourself as a humanity propulsion engineer. Tell me what that means.
Okay. So I'll say this. First of all, my son is an engineer and he would tease me. He said, you can't be an engineer. You have a degree.
You need the ring.
But there's a social engineering. And if you feel like humanity is at a threshold, at a tipping point, in a bad situation, then the objective for all of us, for you included, Jason, is to find a way to propel us forward.
Right.
And so every day I think that today could be my last day. And if today is my last day, how will I be remembered? Who am I? And what I want to be remembered as somebody who cared deeply about humanity and did everything he possibly could do to lead the planet better than it was when I arrived. And now I call that propelling humanity forward.
Got it. And you also talk about this concept of relational legacy. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, that's sort of what parents are, whether it's, you know, subconsciously or consciously sort of doing when they're raising their children. Tell us what that is and describe what you mean by that.
So I think most of us, when we think about legacy, certainly in this country, I hear people all the time, especially in this industry that I work in, I hear people talking about generational wealth. Oh, I want to create generational wealth. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. But if you don't have a relationship with your kids that they understand what wealth actually is, the next generation, they'll be poor. Yep. And most of us are not going to be able to leave generational wealth. But what we can leave is a legacy, a relational legacy with our children, that our children see their responsibility for being intellectually ambitious, being globally and culturally competent, and being humanitarian driven, caring about something greater than themselves. I don't think, Jason, I'll do anything. I may never do anything that the world remembers me for, but if I do enough good stuff as a father, then my son could go on to do something. And when you look in his Wikipedia page and it says who was his father, there you'll see my name appear. And that's thus my legacy, because I poured enough into him. You don't know my dad, but my dad still lives through my relationship now with you. And so like that is the legacy that I think and it should be a positive legacy. So even though I could say terrible things about my father, I won't. I will only say about the things that helped me to be better, that made you interested in having a conversation.
Right. Kind of like the legacy starts at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense. So tell me, you know, through this kind of journey, obviously raising your son and doing all these great things, any challenges that you've kind of faced along the way?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Challenges are everywhere. I mean, so the challenge of trying to do what you think is the best thing to do in the face of what other people would have you to do differently. So even like naming him, when you tell your family that you're going to wait 7 days to name your child, there's the challenge of wanting to revert and do what other folks said. When he was 16 and we said, hey, we're gonna let him leave and go live in Brazil. They're like, you're gonna do what? So for me, one of the greatest challenges is finding a way to be okay with being different. That's the greatest challenge. I was telling a friend the other day, and I see the world that every in this way, that everything is relative and most things are illusory. And so Jason could say Nate's a nice guy. Somebody else could say Nate's a jerk. And what is Nate? Which one is he? Right? Because it's all relative. And so Nate has to figure out, well, it doesn't matter what everybody else is going to say about you. What do you think you should do in this time frame? So that's been the challenging thing to do as a father. Certainly around money is another example. I work in the industry. People care greatly about money and making large amounts of money. That's not very interested in me, but it's hard to be in an environment where that's all you ever hear about. And you're measured and judged by how much money you make or what kind of car you drive or the kind of clothes that you wear. And if you're saying, I want to just be a really great dad, and I'm not thinking about money the same way you all are, that becomes kind of a tough thing too.
Yeah. I guess that concept of like being okay to be different is about, you know, all of us kind of getting comfortable with our insecurities, right?
Yeah. 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 Yep. Yep.
Yeah, it makes sense. So I ask this question to folks on my show all the time, which is there one feeling that you have as a parent that you would rather not feel?
Yes, that I'm getting old and my time is running out. Man, that troubles me greatly. When I first started to gray, my son, I think Nate was about 12 or 13. He said, Daddy, are you getting ready to die? Are you going to die? And he says now that doesn't bother him, but I know my time is drawing near, and that, as his father, I don't want to leave him. I love that guy to death. He is my best friend. I just saw him and spent the weekend with him in Miami 2 weeks ago. That bothers me tremendously, that I'm running out of time.
Yeah, I think you're a bit too young to be recognizing your mortality, but.
I'm 56. My grandfather passed at 65. Men in my family don't typically live that long. My grandmother lived to be 103. So I tease everybody that I'm going to outlive the time.
That's you.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
But it makes me nervous, right? I'm getting older. I'm like, okay, I'm graying. Things are not always moving it the same way I used to move and work before.
I hear you. We'll all start thinking about that at some point, right?
Yeah.
So what is your hope for your audience?
My hope for parents is one that parents will fully engage in their children's lives and understand that they too have a legacy that they're creating with their children, and that we return in some ways to the time when parents were actually committed to making sure that their children's lives were better than theirs. I meet so many kids today who don't have that experience, and we didn't. I always say the children didn't ask to be here. Like we invited them here. They're the guests. So let's like treat them as honored guests for as long as possible and give them an opportunity to be great.
Yeah, I hear you. So Nate, you know, I really appreciate the time that you've been here. It's been fantastic talking to you. Can you just tell the audience where they can reach you?
Okay, so the easiest thing to do, we have a website. It's Nathaniel, NathanielA Turner.com. And once you get there, you'll find everything else we're doing. We also have a organization we found, my wife, my son and I found it, called the League of Extraordinary Parents. And that email address, web address, I'm sorry, is LXTRAP.com.
Got it. Okay. And we'll put those links in our show notes also when we actually publish this. Well, thank you so much, Nate, for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. We would really appreciate if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send us any feedback to reachingroots@wishslate.com. Also, download the Wish Slate app to help organize wish lists for your family and change the way you gift. You can download this from www.wishslate.com/download. Thank you.